my dear friend is suffering as her father is currently suffering. That suffering is absolute and real, and it's very important to them. They're going to need someone who can show them the love of Christ in a quiet, patient way, just like Jesus did. I always point out to people who are all worried about what God thinks about how upset they are about what's happened to them, and I point out to them that, you know, Jesus didn't get mad at Martha, did he? No, he didn't rebuke her for her questions or anything like that, did he? No, he just gave her answers, and he just fixed her situation. So people who are in the middle of suffering and are struggling with the reasons why they need someone who can sit down and show them how Christ loved Mary and Martha while they were watching their brother sit in the grave. And then they need to know that God has a plan and that he is in control of it in the same way that Jesus was in control of it. Now, what are some fundamental concepts that we need to keep in mind? Well, the first thing you need to know is that you don't need a physician's knowledge of illness to help people who are sick. You just need to have a very carefully, you need to be able to listen a long time very carefully and do it with a loving attitude. I always tell people who are studying counseling that in that first session when you're talking to people, give them the first 30 minutes. You know, sit down and listen to them talk for the first 30 minutes and don't interrupt them. Because if you do that, that may be the first time anybody's listened to them that long and as long as they can remember. Do you know how long the average doctor's office visit is in the United States today? How long?
7 minutes.
A little short.
12.
Exactly. 12 minutes. Do you know how long it takes before the doctor decides to interrupt you to redirect the conversation in a direction that he thinks will be more profitable? 35. It's exactly 35 seconds. You all need to remember that. So the next time you go to the doctor, you need to have your speech rehearsed. You know, you get everything down there in the list that you want to get in, and you get it in under 30 seconds. Boom. This is what I need to know, doc, before we get out of here today. Bang, 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 bang. Oh, we shouldn't do that in biblical counseling, should we? No, we should be the people who know how to listen. It was Sir William Osler who started the process of that we know today as residency training, where doctors go and after they graduate from medical school, practice medicine with other doctors for 3 to 5 years so they can learn the trade better. And he said that if you'll let a patient talk long enough, they'll tell you what's wrong if you just let them talk long enough. I've always said that if you let them talk a little longer, they'll tell you what the last guy did that worked too. Now, what's the best source for your information? It's the counselee. You don't need medical records. And unless you're a doctor or a nurse practitioner or a nurse or a physician's assistant, the odds of you understanding the records that you would get are very small, and probably they're not going to be very useful to you. So you really don't need to get them most of the time. Really, you're not so much interested in what they have. You sort of are, but you aren't. What you're really interested in is what they think they have. You know, because that can be an entirely different matter. What they think they have and how they think it will affect and change their life. That's what you want to know. So then you look for the counselee's response to the illness. Your strength in dealing with illness is from a biblical perspective rather than a medical one. I always tell folks that when you go to, you know, even as a physician, I really try not to get very involved in people's medical problems. I won't tell them what to do medically in a biblical counseling session. I send them back to their doctor for lots of good reasons. One is it takes up time, and that's really not why I'm there, and it's really not why you're there. You're there to try to help them learn to deal in a biblical way with the problem that they're facing. So you should accept the diagnosis as a given. If they say they have ADHD or bipolar disorder or self-esteem problems, you know, shouldn't get in any arguments with them about it. Don't try to prove or disprove their diagnosis, and don't recommend other possible diagnoses or methods of diagnosis. And if there's no cure or relief, you shouldn't be attempting to find or recommend an alternative. I would tell you guys that you're not referral agents for the Ohio State University School of Medicine. They have doctors. Whoever you're counseling with has a doctor. Let the doctor do that. Now, you're supposed to be trying to encourage them to respond biblically to the problem that they face. So your goal is going to be to turn their attention from the pain and discomfort of the illness that they're facing to what God is going to do through it, and then how they can minister from that. You know, that's what Paul said, that the God of all comforted us with the coming of Titus. And then he said that we would comfort others with the comfort with which we have been comforted. You know, the best people to help folks who are struggling with illness are people who've had it and people who know how to respond biblically to it. Now, what principles are there that we can learn? Well, the first thing is that you do want to understand your counselee's medical condition to some extent. They're going to tell you basic facts about that condition. And what you really are interested in is, how was it diagnosed? Was it found on a physical exam? Was it found on a CAT scan? Was it found in laboratory work? Or was it one of these pencil and paper tests, the Zung depression or a Hamilton depression rating scale or an ADHD scale or a bipolar scale? There's a big difference between those two kinds of things. All those scales I mentioned, the Zung depression rating scale, Hamilton depression rating scale, those are subjective things. It's sort of like me asking you if you're depressed, and you say, I'm depressed, and then I say back, well, then you're depressed. It's a little more complicated than that, but that's really pretty much what it is. Whereas if you have diabetes and we do a blood test and your blood sugar comes back 500, then we know you have it. If it comes back 100, we know that you don't. So one's very objective and one is subjective. But you want to know from them how it was diagnosed. Then you want to know what they believe the natural course of the disease is. What's the cause? What's the course? What's the cure? What's the conclusion? My favorite one for this is emphysema, chronic obstructive lung disease. What causes chronic obstructive lung disease? Everybody in this room might know.
Okay.
What?
Smoking,
yes, smoking for the most part causes chronic obstructive lung disease. Now, not everybody who gets COPD smokes, but most of the people who get COPD smoked. That's a pretty good way to look at it. So the cause is cigarettes. What's the course? How does it go? You ever watch the guys, they start out with two packs a day, and the next time you see them, they're sitting on a park bench someplace with the oxygen tubes up their nose, and they got a little cart to pull their oxygen bottle with. Guys ever see that? Yeah, you get shorter and shorter of breath, don't you? Yeah, because you lose more and more of your lung capacity. And what's the conclusion if you keep on smoking? Yeah, you'll die. And what's the cure? Quit. That's right. It's like beating yourself on the head with the hammer thing. Yeah, if you just quit, your headache will go away. So that's the cause, the course, the conclusion, and the cure. And that's what you want to know from the counselee. You know, what caused their illness? What do they think the course is going to be? Do they think that this will result in their death? Or will it disable them? You know, what do they think is going to happen to them as a result of having it? How are they going to treat it? What are the effects of that treatment? And what do they think the outcome is going to be? Is this something, you know, like, well, you know, I have a 50% chance of living. The doc told me I have 0% chance of living after 6 months. They tell me I might live 10 or 15 years and then I have to have a liver transplant. You know, what do they think? What has the doctor told them? All right. How will this affect the counselee's lifestyle? And this is really where the rubber meets the road for most people who are sick. Does it take them out of work? Are you talking to someone who is the sole support of their family who can no longer work because they're sick? Is that who you're talking to? That has just such wide effect. You know, it touches everything in the household for that person. How does it affect their recreation? Do they do something as important as golf? Will it keep them off the links? Obviously, you guys don't think that's very important. Some of you have this really strange look on your face. There's one guy, yes, one fellow golfer back there. Well, but does it keep them from doing things that they have to this point enjoyed? You know, it's like I can remember once I run about 35 miles a week, and I can remember I developed a lump in one of my tendons, and I had an orthopedic surgeon who really, as far as I'm concerned, wasn't very bright, but who told me that I had to quit running, and I did. I quit for 6 whole weeks, and then I just kept getting slower and fatter and fatter and slower, and And I decided, well, I went and did a web search myself, looked everything up and decided, they just said, told me to stretch a lot, and if it ruptures, they'd fix it. And I decided that I'd rather run and have my Achilles tendon fixed than not walk again. But that really did affect me a fair amount. It surely did. So recreation, does it keep you out of church? You know, have you been a three-time-a-week church person who suddenly cannot go? Because you can't be there, you can't sit there, you can't get in the car to go there. You know, that major outcome. Does it take you out of Christian service? Have you been a pastor who preaches and who can't talk very well now? I mean, think about it. You know, are someone, a pastor who preaches and teaches and suddenly is losing his vision? You know, think about how this illness might impact a person who day in and day out spends most of their time in Christian service. Or maybe you're the Awana commander and you can't go anymore, and being the Awana commander has been your life for the last 25 years. Then, how does it affect marriage? Does this illness keep the individual from occupying the role of being a husband or a wife or a parent? All those things you want to know. How has it affected the counselee's attitude? Do they view themselves as a victim? Do they view themselves as a victim? We are, aren't we, though, today? We are victims, very much so. If you don't believe it, you just turn the television on at 4 o'clock and watch Dr. Phil. Yeah, that's right. Everybody on Dr. Phil's a victim. I hope you don't watch Dr. Phil. You don't? Good. Praise the Lord. I'm glad you don't. Or is your counselee a soldier in Christ's army? Is he soldiering on? You know, it's like, this is the field that God's put me on. This is the trouble that I have to face, and I will face it. And, you know, it's like there's two choices. Those are your two choices in life. You can either be a victim or you can be a soldier in Christ's army and soldier on. Then what are the responses of the relatives and friends of the counselee? Are they biblically supportive? Are they critical? I remember I had a lady who was coming up for counseling from someplace in northern Indiana, and they called me up in Lafayette, and one of the family members was delegated to call me, and the family member said, "We just want you to know that we think Mom's normal, and we'd like for you to tell her that and tell her to get back here and get back to cooking and cleaning." That was exactly what they said. I didn't do that. So are they supportive? Are they critical? Do they encourage your counselee to be a victim, or do they encourage your counselee to be a victor? What's the effect of the medicine? Does it slow their thinking down? Some medications do. Does it make them sick? How is the illness being treated or managed? You know, it's like prostate cancer. Are they going to have surgery? Are they going to get to have radiation? Is the treatment going to be effective? And does the counselee see it as effective? Does the counselee think he's going to make it, or do they think they're going to die? And then what are the potential complications from the use of the treatment, the medication? Big deal is, will their hair fall out? I suspect that for every woman who's ever had breast cancer, that's probably the second question, is my hair going to fall out? Then what's their spiritual condition? You know, if you're talking to somebody who's sick and who might die, you really ought to be finding out if they know the Lord or not. You know, have to be really straightforward at that point. What's their personal relationship with the Lord? And the way that I do that with almost all counselees is I usually carry a bunch of EE tracks, but I gave my last one out with the tip at the hotel before I left today, so I don't have it with me. But what I do is I'll ask the counselee two questions. The first one is, have you come to the place in your spiritual life that you know for certain that if you died today that you'd be with God in heaven? Or is that something that you're still working on? And then I'll write their answer down. And then the second question is that if you did die today and you stood before God and he asked you, why should I let you into my heaven, what would you say? And from that I know two things. One, whether or not they think they are a Christian and they're going to heaven. And two, why they think that. And you know, to be real honest with you, if they give me the wrong answers, you know, a lot of people might say, well, the most important thing you could do with the rest of the hour then or the rest of your time is to share the gospel with them. But I don't. And the reason why I don't is because if I spend the rest of the hour talking to them about the gospel, what do you think happens in the second hour? They don't come back. Yeah, because they think I'm tone deaf. They came in and told me that they had a problem. They wanted me to deal with it, and I talked about something entirely different for all the time they were there. Now, what good is that? They won't come back. So what I do is I give them a tract, an EE tract, very simple gospel tract, easy to read, and I ask them to read it, underline 5 sentences, and when they come back the next time, we'll talk about it. And that's how I deal with it. You know what happens? They go home and read it. And you know what some of them do? They get down beside their bed and they ask Christ to save them before they can even get back and I can talk to them. You know, it's amazing. It's very low tech, I know, but it works. Then, how does the counselee or the person fit God into their problem? Do they blame God? Do they see Him as sovereign? Or do they see Him totally disconnected from their trouble and from life? And then what is his understanding or her understanding of the authority of the Word of God in their life? You know, it's important to know whether your counselee believes, and the way I phrase it is that if we read something in the Bible and it applied to what you were doing, would you think that you were obligated to do it? You know, that's kind of the question that I ask. Would you think that you were obligated to do it? If they say no, then I know we're going to have some educating to do. And if they say yes, then I know my job's going to be a little easier. Then you need to identify your counselees, the problems that they're bringing with them, what their presenting issues are and what their underlying heart issues are. And generally speaking, people who are struggling with their illness are dealing with fear and they're dealing with worry. They're dealing with anger. And they're also pretty generally self-focused. It's like somebody just told you you're going to die. What are you thinking about? Well, you're not thinking about how the neighbor's garden is growing, are you? No, you're thinking about the guy just told me I'm going to die. And so you need to know that because, well, they need to get their focus shifted eventually for them to do well. All right, you need to give them hope. Hope. And the hope is that there can be victory when pain and suffering cannot be relieved. And in order to do that, you need to teach them about what Jesus did with Lazarus and the promises that come with it. You teach the promises of God regarding God's character and His good plans for His children. I have a family that I've counseled with who have a real struggle, and they have a struggle with a child. I taught them John 11 because of the struggle they were facing. And they went home and taught the child John 11. And it helped the child. You know, it helped the child to know that Jesus knew about Lazarus. It helped the child to know that Jesus wept and cared about Lazarus. Why? Because then the child knew that Jesus cared about her. Yeah, that Jesus cared about her. So you teach them the promises of God. Then you have to cast a vision of what God can do through His Word and His Spirit in people's lives. They need to know that that Jesus has a use for the problem that they're facing. Boy, that they need to know that they're going to get the opportunity to share the gospel with people. They're going to have the opportunity to be a testimony to other people as they deal with their illness. And you illustrate that, how victory is possible even in the midst of human frailty and difficult circumstances. When I think about that, I think about Lloyd Jonas. Lloyd used to teach up at Lafayette. Actually, he came from Massachusetts, and he came over for several years and taught up at Faith Biblical Counseling Ministries. And I can remember when Lloyd got cancer of the prostate. And Lloyd, they did the radiation thing. And You know, that's the deal where you go over and they put you in the machine and do things that I'm not going to talk about. And then they turn the radiation on and they aim it at the area where the cancer is, where your prostate is, and they hope to kill the cancer as a result. And generally, they do. Now, most of us, I would think, I don't know about you guys, but most of us, doesn't it bother you when the dental hygienist runs out of the room before she pulls the trigger on the X-ray machine? You sit real still here, and you stay here. I have to go out, but then and I'll be right back in. Don't you ever wonder, why they have to leave and why you have to stay? Well, multiply that by about 1,000 or maybe 10,000. That's what Lloyd's think, you know, what Lloyd's facing. You know, big time radiation, not just this little burst that gets, you know, the picture of whether you have holes in your teeth or not. No, and most of us, we'd be thinking about that, wouldn't we? We'd be kind of focused in on that idea, wouldn't we, guys? Yeah, I think so. But Lloyd wasn't. And Lloyd, oh, I think you have to go 39 times or something like that. And you know who Lloyd was thinking about? He was thinking about the guy who was pushing the button. Yeah, he was thinking about the guy who was pushing the button. And every time Lloyd would go, Lloyd would share part of the gospel with the guy who was pushing the button. And you know what happened before Lloyd was done getting his radiation done? The guy who pushed the button got saved. Yeah. That's because Lloyd, in the middle of his illness, was not focused on Lloyd. Lloyd was thinking about other people, thinking about how he could glorify God, how God could use it. And your counselees need to do that. You also need not be manipulated by a counselee's behavior. You know, there are all kinds of people who are wandering around today saying that I can't do any better because I have. Anybody know anybody like that? I have this acronym. It's usually three or four letters, and they'll say, the reason why I did was with this because the doctor says I have dot, 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 you know, and because I have dot, 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 then that's the reason I am that way. And quite frankly, I'm here to tell you, you know, for the most part, it's not true. I have to go down through the whole list to tell you specifically which ones I'm certain that it's not true for. But you don't have to write the counselee's behavior off and their response to their illness, to their illness per se, most of the time. Now, another thing you need to do is use biblical terminology to describe their problem. You know, when people come in and they tell me that they have things like obsessive compulsive disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, or bipolar disorder, or ADHD, and stuff like that, I don't argue with them about the label. All I do is go to work on the behavior that I see, you know, and then I go to the scriptures and we describe the behavior that I see from the scriptures, and then we deal with the scriptural solution to that problem. And so, when somebody comes in and they say that they have a mood disorder and because of that they're angry and they hit people, well, you know, really what they are angry people, aren't they? Yes, and the Bible has a cure for anger. Yeah, it really does. All right, now, the counselee needs to know that there's hope, that there can be victory when pain and suffering cannot be relieved. But at the same time, don't minimize or maximize a person's symptoms. You know, when people come to tell me that they hurt, I really wish I had a tool that I could stick in the side of their head. You know, like your car. You know, you hook your car up to the computer and it tells the mechanic everything that's busted. And really, when it comes to pain, I really wish I had something I could stick in the side of people's head and says, yeah, this one hurts. Oh, this one not so much, you know, or something like that. But I can't do that. And so when people come and tell me that they're struggling and they're hurting, I don't either try to encourage them to revel in it, and I don't try to tell them that I don't think that they have a problem either way. You have to build involvement with the counselee. Now, to me, building involvement with the counselee means that the relationship has to grow beyond the hour that they're in the room. I don't think biblical counseling works very well as a set piece apart from a small group, people who will be friends and hold you accountable, a church. You know, I think that in some way, shape, or form, a counselee has to have more contact with the body of Christ than just an hour in counseling in order to do very well. So you have to develop a meaningful relationship. Need to emphasize God's grace in your life and in theirs. You know, the truth of the matter is that the gospel that saved us is the gospel that enables us to live through any trial. The only way that we can grow and change and become more like Christ is because of the grace of God. I'm not, you know, Christians aren't smarter, they aren't better, they are saved. And God enables them to change and do the things that He wants them to do by grace and by the power of the indwelling Holy Spirit that lives inside their heart. then you look for ways to identify with the counselee's story. I always like what Doc Bob Smith said to me once. I take this off. It is warming up. Yes. I had a counselee who was doing something in his marriage that I honestly thought I was guilty of. This is really bad. My wife's sitting right back there. And so now she'll hear this. But anyway, and I told Doc that. I said, Doc, you know, I really hate to rake this guy over about this because honestly, I sort of think I'm kind of guilty. And he looked at me and he said, that's really great, Charlie. He said, it's a wonderful thing when God lets your lips say the words that your ears need to hear. Yeah. I keep my day timer open when I'm counseling, and when I think of something that I'm talking to a counselee about and I realize it's my problem, I reach over and write myself a note. So you look for ways to identify with their story. Encourage them when they take steps of growth. Always praise progress in the life of any counselee. All right. Now, want to evaluate their problem biblically. You're going to encourage them by evaluating their problem biblically. And the first thing you're going to do is distinguish between suffering and occasions of sinning. Some people are suffering because they worked at it. I mean, that is true. And then there are other people whose suffering was delivered to them. Like my friend who was driving down State Road 37 and a guy came across the midline, hit him head on. His wife in the front seat was killed. He was in the hospital unconscious, and his four small children all survived in the back seat, left him a broken up widower with four small kids. And of course, the drunk lived, because they always do. I don't know why that is, but the guy who decided to drink and drive, he lived. He decided that he could sin, and my friend suffered. You know how my friend got even with him? He went to jail and forgave him. That's how my friend got even with him. So some of us suffer because we earn it, and others of us suffer because other people deliver it to us. But I'll tell you, the real problem is that sometimes we merge that. You know, it's like something happened to us, and then we decide to respond in an unbiblical way, and suddenly we move out of the suffering because of someone else's behavior and suffering because I'm compounding the problem. So in dealing with people who are ill, you need to encourage them to get appropriate medical care and treatment. You're going to help the counselee evaluate their suffering for biblical reasons for illness. The first reason why people suffer is because it works out to God's glory. I had a dear friend, is Steve Jarnigan, and I can remember he was probably 35, he had three small kids, and he developed renal cell carcinoma. And fortunately, he was given what was then an experimental treatment called interferon, and he got a remission that lasted for 5 years, and we were all deeply grateful for it. But I tell you this, it's changed my friend Steve's outlook completely about life. And I always call that the yellow light of life. You know, you didn't get the red light. You didn't step off the curb, get hit by the milk truck, and you're gone. I mean, he got notice. And you know what he did when he got his notice? He decided he was going to spend the rest of his life serving God in any way that he could. He became the Awana commander and became the biggest duck in the puddle in Awana. He helped start another ministry at our church called Grace Cancer Care, where he and another cancer survivor went out and visited people in the county that they got referrals from the Cancer Society for people who were ill with cancer and who needed to know what resources they could count on. And when they got done telling them about the services that were available, then my friend Steve would tell them how they could live forever. And then he started one more ministry. It was called the Blooming Idiots. You guys interested? Marno? Yeah, okay. He and another couple people, they started planting flowers in this garden area and on the front of our church. And they planted so many flowers that it became the largest outdoor flower garden with a church in the county. And people would drive onto our church property just to look at it. Unsaved people, you know. They just had an interest in flowers. He was tricky about that. So Steve planned to live for God's glory. He also viewed the illness as a benefit because it told him that life is short. You know, you don't have a long time. All of us sort of live with this immortality complex where we think we have a lease on life and we're going to live forever, but it's not true. I don't know where the last 60 years went. I don't know about you, but it's gone pretty fast for me. My friend Steve, he knew that time was short. So it can be a benefit to a counselee. And then we get to suffer because of sin. Now I need for you all to wake up for a minute. Are you awake? If you're awake, would you say amen?
Amen.
Well, that's pretty anemic. Could you do that again and convince me?
Amen.
Yes, you're awake. Now look me right in the eye, my eyes and your eyes. Are we hooked? All right, now I need for you to repeat after me. Dr. Hodges,
did not say
that if I sinned
and I had a cold,
it was because I sinned. Okay, so I just wanted to have you say that because somebody will wake up in the middle of this and they'll go out of here saying that guy just said that everybody who gets sick is sick because they sin. No. We get sick because Adam and Eve sinned, first and foremost. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered the world and death by sin, so death has passed upon all men for all have sinned. Yes, I have wrinkles that Eve gave me. You know, I wasn't looking for them. Yes. Wonder what it was like to live in a perfect place with a perfect husband. We'll never know. But anyway, we get sick because Adam and Eve sinned, and it's the natural course of life. And then we, as my friend, we get sick because other people sin at times, and we have suffering because of it. And then, folks, I'll tell you real honestly, sometimes you get sick because you do sin. Yes. And I can tell you this, that if you're here tonight and you're living in unrepented, presumptuous sin against God, you should be very careful because God could kill you. And the reason why I say that is because the Bible does. That's what he did with that's what he offered to do with the adulterer in 1 Corinthians 5. It's what he did with the people who got drunk at communion in 1 Corinthians 11. Some, many are weak and sickly among of you, and some of you sleep. So we get sick because of sin in one way, shape, form, or another. And your counselee needs to know that. Sometimes you talk to little old ladies and, you know, they probably haven't done anything much wrong as long as anybody can remember, and they're sick and they're laying there convinced that, you know, the reason why I'm sick is because I sinned. And, you know, my brother says, he'll ask him, well, what did you do? And he says, I don't know. You know, obviously those people are working under a misconception of illness and sin, and they need to have it corrected from a biblical viewpoint. All right. Then you apply appropriate biblical principles to the problems that the counselee faces. Counselees face the same kind of problems that healthy people do. Healthy people have anger, fear, worry, communication problems. They need to know about progressive sanctification. They need to know about grace. They need to know about salvation. And guess what? Sick people have all those same kind of problems, but even they're usually a little more intensified. So you would deal with the problems that they're facing according to the biblical principles that you've been learning throughout this course. I haven't got time to talk to you about anger, fear, and worry, although we will talk about worry to the max in the next hour. Your counselee needs to think biblically about all aspects of the illness. I like Philippians 4:8 a lot because of that. It says we're supposed to think about whatsoever things are true. Yeah, true. A lot of other things, but true. And if something hasn't happened yet, is it true? No. And I think it was like Winston Churchill who said that half the people in the country spend most of their days worrying about things that never happen. Yeah, that's right. So, you know, counselees need to be diverted away from spending all their time thinking about the horrible what-ifs and towards thinking about the things that they can be doing. They need to take captive their thoughts about Christ. They need to understand that God cares about the pain and suffering of his children and has a plan for it. Think about the guy in John 9, the blind guy. He's sitting along the side of the road, and here comes Jesus with his disciples, and they ask him the question, who sinned, this man or his parents, that this guy was born blind? The thing I always think that's kind of funny about that is that the man wasn't deaf. Think about it. You know, you're sitting there blind. You've been blind for 40 years, and somebody's asking, did this guy sin to get himself? Well, anyway, you guys are a little tough crowd here tonight. Must be dinner or something like that, digesting. Anyway, that guy had sat there for a really long time. So what? So that Jesus come along on a given day and heal him. You know, that's exactly why he was there. And that's exactly why he suffered. And counselees need to understand it, that God has a plan for their illness and the outcome of it. They also need to know that illness and suffering are to be expected. All who are godly will suffer persecution. I can tell you this, it's appointed unto man once to die, period, end of line. Unless Jesus Christ comes back first, you are all going to get sick and die. That's what my business is all about. Well, anyway, this trying to prevent it or something like that. They also, counselees need to know that the illness is under control of a sovereign God. You know, my favorite book in the Bible is the Gospel of John. That's where I saw Jesus the first time. I mean, really saw him. Someplace in about chapter 14 through 18. On a dark evening in the fall while I was a freshman in college, I read those four chapters and I saw Jesus. My favorite book in the Bible. You want to guess what my least favorite book in the Bible has been? Job, that's exactly right. Think about it. 40 some odd chapters on suffering, and it's just the same thing over and over again. Job gets more boils, he has more problems, his friends come and they open. You know, his friends were pretty good counselors until they opened their mouths. You should all keep that in mind, you know. As long as they didn't say anything, they were doing pretty good. It was when they opened their mouths that they got in trouble. Oh, yes. I mean, Paul could tell us about rejoicing in four chapters in Philippians. I mean, he could tell us about it, and he was done with it. I mean, but then one day I realized that everything I know about suffering, I know because of Job. Yes. And I also figured out that Job didn't. I don't know that Job ever actually knew what, on this side of life, what was going on. I don't believe he did. I think all he knew at the end is that God is all-powerful and he can do as he pleases. Job understood that at the end. But what do we know about it? Because of Job, we know that God knew. We know that God had a plan. We know that there was this argument going on in heaven between God and Satan. We know that Job was an upright man. We know that God cared. We know that it was limited. We know there was a reward. We know all of those things, don't we? When I figured that out, I repented in sackcloth and ashes. Anyway. All right. We have to also teach the counselee that God won't exceed a believer's ability to handle the unpleasantness of any illness. We indeed can do all things through God who strengthens us. And that God intends for believers to have victory in the midst of the agony of illness. You know, I like Romans 8, 35 through 37 because it tells me one thing about life. I don't care if I die in the last room on the longest hallway in the dirtiest nursing home on the face of the earth all by myself. I will not be alone. Period. The angels will be there and they will conduct us into his presence. So, we're never abandoned, never alone, and your counselee needs to know that. Then, we need to have compassion for the reality of the suffering of our counselee, and we need to give them a definition of what victory is. Victory, in this case, is being controlled by biblical principles rather than the agony of the illness, not being controlled by a constant pursuit of relief from pain and suffering. I'm not saying that people need to hurt needlessly. I'm just saying it shouldn't become the main thing in your life. If it becomes the main thing in your life, it'll bump other important things out of the way. Victory is being controlled by what God is doing as a result of the condition and focusing on God's purposes for the discomfort rather than the discomfort itself. Yeah. And it provides a response when relief doesn't come. My friend Steve's cancer came back, and he eventually died of it. And my brother sat with him when he was in the hospital through that period of time. And he was on a morphine drip, and you know how it kind of goes. He sort of would fade in and out. He would be reasonable and logical at times, and other times he'd just be delirious. And it was on one evening when he was delirious that my brother was there, and he was convinced that the nurse was trying to murder him. You have to be a doctor to appreciate the humor in situations like this. We develop a sort of dark sort of humor. Here the man is dying of cancer and he's worried that the nurse is going to kill him. And because of that, he wouldn't take the pills. He had medicine that he was supposed to take and he refused to take it because he was certain she was poisoning him. So my brother was trying to convince him to take his medicine and the nurse was trying to convince him to take the medicine. And finally, he came to for a while. And he looked up and he said, "Oh, okay. I'll take my medicine, but you got to answer me two questions first." And she said, "Sure," because, you know, for her, it was like two questions, the pills go down his throat, and she goes off to do the rest of her work, because she probably had three or four other patients she was supposed to be taking care of. And so he looked up at her and said, "Okay, have you come to the place in your spiritual life that you know for certain that if you died today, that you'd be with God in heaven?" Yeah. A dead man can do this. You know that? A guy who's dying, he can say most anything he wants to, and people will pay attention to it and give deference to it just because he's dying. Yes. And she thought about it a moment, and she said, "Well, yeah, I think I'd go to heaven." And then he said, "Well, the second question is that if you did die and you stood before God and he asked you, 'Why should I let you into my heaven?' what would you say?" And she looked at him a moment and said, "Well, you know, I try to be a good person. You know, I became a nurse so I could help other people." This was a Catholic hospital. And I don't try to hurt anybody." And he looked up at her and said, "Wrong answer." Just like that. And then he looked at my brother and told him that he needed to tell her the rest of the story. You know, he could do that. And the reason why he could do it was because he wasn't so focused in on himself that he couldn't see that the nurse who was taking care of him needed to know more about Jesus than he did. Why? Because he was dying and he knew Christ. He was going to heaven. He knew where he was going. And he was going to go down swinging. He wasn't going to go out whimpering. We need to teach the counselee that God's grace is sufficient at times like this and under these kind of circumstances. As Paul said, when Paul asked God three times to heal him, you'd think if anybody could get healed, Paul could, wouldn't you? Yeah, you know, he was right up there close, you know, and God told him, "No, three times, my grace is sufficient for you. You can work under these circumstances. Just keep going." And we need to instill in them an understanding of God's word so as to stimulate faith and obedience during illness. We need to teach them what the scriptures say so they'll know what to do when the time comes. All right, moving on. Homework that you give ought to focus on biblical principles the counselee needs to apply rather than health issues. You should encourage the counselee to follow basically good principles of health, but your main emphasis ought to be on the application of biblical principles to their response to the illness and the symptoms. Now, victory for individuals suffering with a medical illness may include the alleviation of pain and suffering. I believe that God heals people. I really do that, believe that. I'm a doctor, you know, by this time when I start talking about my dear friends and they've all dead, people will look at me and say, "Well, I'd like to know you professionally, but I don't think I want to be your friend." This dear friend out in California, and she had started off with polycystic kidney disease, had a renal transplant, had cancer of the colon, survived that, all those things, to get ovarian cancer, and then have her kidneys fail. And at that point in time, she was being dialyzed, and she decided that since she was dying of ovarian cancer that she didn't want to be dialyzed anymore. And I didn't think that was an unreasonable idea. I didn't have any argument with it. And so I was waiting. I sent my wife out to California. I was doing these every 3-day rotating reservations because they wanted me to come and sing at the funeral. About the last thing in the world I could think of I wanted to do was go sing at my best friend's funeral. And my friend Charles was staying up all night and taking care of her, and then the women and people would come in from church during the day and take care of her, and he would sleep at night during the day. Because it's easier to get people to come during the day than it is to get them to come and sit at night. Think about that. You know, the next time you get somebody sick in your church, yeah, volunteer to sit at night some. So he had gone to bed. This is in January. It's in Sacramento. The sun doesn't shine much in January. It rains January and February in Sacramento. She's in a hospital bed underneath the picture window, and Charles goes back and lays down. And pretty soon he hears this commotion. And he gets up because he thinks that Martha's passed. You know, Martha's gone. And he goes into the front room, and everybody's sort of standing around Martha, and there is this beam of sunlight. Now, this sounds really hokey. Understand I am rational, and this really did happen. This beam of sunlight is coming in January when the sun doesn't shine in Sacramento, and it's shining on Martha. I mean, literally. And from that point on, Martha got better every day. I'm not joking. Her kidney started working again. Her cancer went away. I can remember maybe it was 6 months later, the hospice people came to visit her one day, and she met them at the front door, and they wanted to come in and see her, and she said, "That's fine, but could we make this kind of quick because I need to go shopping." They discharged her from hospice that day. They didn't think they needed to see her anymore. And, you know, life went along pretty well for her for 2 solid years. And after a couple years, the Sacramento Bee, which is by no means a conservative newspaper. I didn't think there was anything conservative in California. But they published a whole page article about Martha and about what God had done in her life. And the next week, her cancer came back. And within a month, she was dead. Just like that. And I can remember going out to the funeral, and my friend Charles just saying, "I just don't understand how or why God would do that, you know? Why would God do that? He raised her up and then he took her away." And about all I could tell him was, "Well, think about Lazarus for a minute, Charles. You know, just think about Lazarus. You know, he's been in heaven for 4 days and he gets this email from God. Lazarus, you're going back." "What do you mean going back? I don't want to go back. Heaven's really nice. I do not want to go down there with those stinky, violent people." Boom, he's down there. Yeah, I don't think Lazarus thought that it was a promotion to leave heaven and go back to earth. Do you? No, I don't think so at all. And then, what happens to Lazarus again? Lazarus gets to do it all over again. I said, "Charles, that's the only answer I have for you, is that God was glorified by his raising up Lazarus and taking him home again, and God was glorified by raising Martha up and taking her home again." So it may actually be the alleviation of pain and suffering, but through it all, in Martha's life, biblical truth was exemplified to everybody who knew her and all the readers of the Sacramento Bee, and God gave her the endurance to finish, and God will give you and your counselee the endurance to finish strong in these kind of things. And then we need to make sure that the counselee understands that in the process, they get to have God's peace when they trust him and in his grace. And that the counselee gets to see God's glory expressed in their life like Martha did. And finally, we need to make sure that the counselee has faith that God is in control and what he's allowing is for their good. Now, what this results in is a deepening relationship between the counselee and God, because I tell you, folks, we don't grieve like other people who don't have hope, do we? No. We don't have to. I don't know how people go to funerals for unsaved people. I mean, I've been to them. I've looked, and it's just like it's almost like you have to insulate yourself mentally from what, the consequences are. It's a lot easier to go to funerals. I had 5 aunts. My wife and I, we had 5 aunts die last year aunts and uncles over about a year period of time. One of them, I don't know where he is. Now, the reason why I say that is because I think I do know where he is, and I just don't want to say it. You know, I guess I do think I know where he is. But the other four, I didn't have any doubt, and it wasn't hard to go to their funerals. You know, it's like I know where they are, and I know I'll see them again. So we as believers, we don't have to grieve over the idea that we're dying or that our loved ones have died, because we will see them again. This life is not the end. Always keep in mind that Paul struggled with his desire to go to heaven or stay here and minister. One of the very important things that you can do for counselees is that you can keep them informed as to what's going to happen. When Steve was in the hospital last time and dying, his wife came to me one day and she said, you know, she was just beside herself. And the reason why is that he had three doctors. One would come in and say that he was dying. The other would come in and say that he was about the same. And a third would come in and say that he was getting better. And this was going on day after day. And I finally looked at her and I said, well, tell me this. Which one of the doctors do you like? And she said, well, the oncologist, which was a really good thing because he was a friend of mine and a Christian. And I said, okay, do this. And this is important. If you don't get anything else out of this lecture, get this. You call his office and tell him that you need an appointment to talk with him at the office for about 45 minutes and you'll pay him. Don't try to do this at the hospital when he's visiting or making rounds. Do this at the office. And you go down and you sit down with him and you say, I need to know the answer to two questions. Is my husband going to die? And if he is, how's it going to happen? And she did. She went and talked to my friend, the oncologist, Howard Lee, and she asked him those questions, and he said, sure, he's going to die. And then he explained to her how it was going to happen. And from that point on, she was good with it. I mean, you know, it was a great relief to her. It was the uncertainty that was killing her. It wasn't the fact that her husband was going to pass. She kind of knew that deep down inside her heart. And always keep in mind that other than sudden death or if the Lord delays his return, everybody here is going to die of some illness. And that is how God intends to bring us to himself in heaven. Do you guys want to know how I want to die? Anybody even have the faintest interest? Okay, this is how I want to die. I want to be running my last marathon. I want to be running my last 26-mile race, and I want to be headed towards the finish line. And I want a runaway milk truck, to break through the crowd and come up from behind and hit me really hard and knock me across the finish line. Yeah, because that way I will have finished, and it'll make the evening news. All right, that's the end of the lecture. What questions do you have? Okay, this is question time on this lecture. Yes? Yes. Yes, it's the natural course of things. So what's the question?
Well, how would you counsel somebody that doesn't want to, you know, you do something stupid, say, for saving your life, you cause yourself harm. What's the best way to counsel with somebody that will say, well, God let this happen? You'll get that a lot, won't you?
Well, he does let it happen. I mean, that is entirely true. I think the best way to counsel a person in that regard is a really good look at Romans 8:28-29, you know, where it says, and we know all things work together for good. Now, the issue is that this person is working on probably emotion as opposed to thinking. So the first thing they have to do is they have to understand and know what the promises of God are, with regard to how he takes care of us. So we know that all things, that means everything, all things. You know, if you look at the Greek for that word all, and you parse it out real carefully, and you do a good research on its, yeah, that's it. That's all it is. Yes, that's it. That means everything. It includes stepping on the rake, or the guy who jumps in the river and saves the person and bruises his heart and is disabled because of it. I read about a guy like that once. You know, he's going to spend the rest of his life physically limited because he saved somebody.
Yeah.
So, all things, including that, work together for good. To those who... That means that This only works for Christians. It's not going to be much help for you if you're talking to an unsaved person. To those who love God, and then it further subdivides it down to those who are called according to His purpose. And that's where the issue comes. The issue is, you know, it's like God telling me no. No, I don't get to go on living like the way I've been living in the past, and life isn't going to go on as it always has. It's, you know, I've always thought that as a doctor, I ought to have a car that is more appropriate to my profession. You know, one that starts with an A. Like, what starts with an A that would be good for a doctor? Aston Martin, or an Audi, or an Acura, any of those. Instead, I have a 2000 Honda Accord with 200,000 miles on it. And see, it's that distance between what I think I want and what God gives me, you know. That's what causes the trouble. We are all real into that part about God providing all our needs until we find out that God is the one who writes the need list, not us. So all things work together for good to those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. And what is His purpose? That we all be healthy, wealthy, and wise, or? Yeah, so that we become more like Christ. Your counselee has to be moved to that viewpoint. They cannot stay back at the other viewpoint and do well. They have to decide whether they want to be a victim. A great place to counsel people from for that is Genesis 37 through 50. Take them through, have them read about Joseph through his whole life. Two questions. Is your life worse than Joseph's? Is your life worse than Joseph's? And what did Joseph do every time he got knocked on his backside? Those are the two questions. And Joseph comes down to it at the end and says what? You meant it for evil, God meant it for good. So I've taken people with very gnarly stories and had them and worked them through Genesis 37 through 50, and that's very productive. Other question? Yes.
You mentioned not being controlled by a constant pursuit of relief from pain and suffering. Where do you draw the line between counted worthy to suffer versus alleviating pain?
You know, that is a big question today, because the prescriptions that are written for Vicodin in the United States, I think if you put them all in one spot, could reach to the moon. I mean that. There's one drugstore in the southwest side of Indianapolis that 60% of the pills that they prescribe are narcotics right now. I know that to be true. When I started practicing medicine before the Civil War in 1975, we were taught to be very careful about writing prescriptions for narcotics. And the reason why we were taught to be very careful about it is because they are personality-changing, mind-altering, addictive drugs, period. So, you know, when I look at it as a physician, I have to say that do no harm is my primary goal in life. You know, I want to make you better. I would like for you to feel better. I don't want to harm you in the process. And so it makes me very conservative about the pain medication that I write for. I have three criteria that I don't argue with. One is that you've been burned, two, that you have a broken bone, and three, you have cancer. You know, and those get to be, I don't quibble about. The rest of it, you know, it's like I have to sit and very carefully try to help the person not make a choice that's going to ruin their life. You know, it's that I think is the balance. I think the issue I think comes to be is what are we going to be controlled by? And I think it was Paul who said that I won't be controlled by things and substances. I won't be controlled by any of them. I forget what where the verse is, but you can put that in your electronic Bible Works word search and you'll find it. It's like, what is it? Be not drunk with wine, but be controlled by the Holy Spirit. The things that we put into us can control us. And so, I know I'm stumbling around here a little bit because it's really not an easy question to answer, frankly. But my view of it is that I want the patient to understand that the medicine that they may be asking me for will change their personality. And it will not be in a nice way, period. And the suffering that they face, the discomfort that they face, may be more valuable to them than the comfort that they find along with the personality changes that will be seen. That, I think, is the issue in medicine today. So, did I answer your question, or did I just stumble around here for 5 minutes?
No, I think you got at it. I would be curious, from a pastoral standpoint of being more informed about those types of drugs and then in a counseling practice of when to know that somebody's been prescribed this, that they're seeking this, to refer them to somebody reputable to pull them off of this, and some of those practical issues that go along with it.
You know, for broad general statements, it's hard to make broad general statements about things like that. What would be really good is if you had a physician that you trusted that you could raise the questions with. Is this a reasonable thing to do? And you can always email me. You know, my email address is on the NANC thing. So if you want to ask questions about specific cases, I can probably give you a hint. But that's probably as good as I'm going to get on that question in this setting. All right, you want to take a break? All right, let's take a break.